We're going to go ahead and start the formal part of this presentation. Please continue to eat. We're on a pretty tight schedule, and we want to make sure that we get out of here in time for the 2 o'clock conferences. I'd like to take this opportunity right now to thank the 41 people from the Rogers Hornsby chapter and the Larry Durker chapter who volunteered to help put this presentation, this convention together. We've had a lot of fun in the last 15 months working on this project. You can tell who we are by the orange shirts. And we have our special leadership team sitting over here on the to my left. Incidentally, if you'll look at your seat, you will see a ticket, a coupon, that's good for free Minute Maid orange juice. That's the courtesy of Minute Maid and Fred Arnold. Thanks so much. I'd also like to mention my co-chairmen who are sitting up here at the front table, my wife Peggy, Marcia Franti, Gilbert Martinez, and his wife Ray Ann. They've been great. We also appreciate the dedicated work of the Sabre staff from Phoenix who've been over here. Yeah, Deb, Jane, Jacob Pamoki, sorry Jacob, Jeff Shansky, and the intern Coral Marshall. Thanks, guys. I also like to recognize one individual who's in the room. Some of you may have seen the trophy that's sitting up here right beside the podium. This is a Texas League championship trophy from 1951 when the Houston Buffs won it all. There are only two remaining Houston Buffs who are with us, and one is with us today, the hard slugging outfielder Larry Miggins. Larry. Larry did move on from the Buffs to the St. Louis Cardinals, but as an outfielder, he said he had a tough time breaking into the lineup. He said they had some guy named Slaughter who was playing left field and another guy named Musial who was playing right field. And the center fielder was an all-star, Whitey Kurowski. Kind of tough, but he did make it to the show. And if you have a chance, you ought to ask him about his association with Vin Scully. We'll have the trophy out on the solid auction table after this meal. You can take a look at it and take a picture of it. It's pretty impressive. We also want to take this opportunity to wish the Chicago chapter well on Sabre 45. Rich Hansen and his group have a lot of fun in front of them. Our keynote speaker today is here with his wife, Judy. Larry Durker is a Houston icon, and he's the man for whom we have named our Sabre chapter. He's had a long and distinguished career, not only as a baseball player, but as a broadcaster, a manager, and a baseball historian. As many of you know, Larry came to Houston at age 18, pitched his first game at age 18 at Old Colt Stadium, and one of the first batters he faced was a guy named Willie Mays. Yeah, I don't know who was more nervous. The young man facing his first major league opponent or the wily outfielder who didn't know what to expect from this hard-throwing guy. Larry won because he struck out Willie. Larry has set many franchise records with the Astros, having won 20 games in 1969, leaving the team in career starts, career innings, and his third in career victories. In addition, on July 9th, 1976, he pitched a no-hitter against the Montreal Expos. After his playing career, he went on to an outstanding broadcasting career with the Astros on both radio and television. He was selected as manager of the club in 1997, and he managed the team for 5 years, and he went to the playoffs for those 5 years. Pretty impressive record. His managerial winning percentage is .533. Currently, Larry is a special advisor to the president of the Astros, Reed Ryan, and he's also an advocate for literacy. Please help me welcome Larry Durker.
Thank you, Bob. It's really an honor for me to be associated with the Houston chapter of Sabre and to meet all you people from out of town who have come in to enjoy our city and what baseball means to us. This is going to be a little bit of a different speech for me because I've never really read a speech before. I've always just held an index card in my hand with some bullet points. And a lot like J.R. Richard used to hold up 8 baseballs in his hand like that. So I could have my whole speech in my hand. Now I've got 10 pages. And the reason I've decided to do it this way is because of you. If I were just talking to a bunch of random people in the audience that may or may not be baseball fans, I would just talk extemporaneously. But I don't want to leave anything out. And a lot of times when I do it the other way, I finish and I say, I should have talked about that. So I'm going to make sure I talk about everything today, and I hope it's not too long. How many of you are from outside of Houston? All right. Welcome. We've got a pretty good secret here, I think. We've probably never been as much in the limelight as some other franchises, but what a wonderful place to have a baseball career. I would like to be the one that talks to potential free agents about signing with the Astros. Because when you play here, as I know after being here for 50 years, we got rained in once, but we've never been rained out. We've never played when it's really cold. We've never played a steamy doubleheader in July. We've never had a rain delay where we had to sit around for hours playing cards and then resume playing. We just go to the ballpark, everything's pleasant, take batting practice, play the game, and go home day after day. And for somebody that's a worker in the business, you really appreciate that. And you don't get it all the time when you're on the road. Yes, I pitched against the Giants on my 18th birthday and struck out Willie Mays, and in some ways you might say that was the definitive event of my entire career, and it happened in the first inning that I pitched. But actually, I think the thing that changed the trajectory of what I've done in baseball happened 32 years later. I know many of you have heard the Woody story. I can tell because a lot of you have your Hawaiian shirts on. But if you have a really good story, I don't think it's wrong to tell it one more time. In September of 1996, I was broadcasting, and the Astros in the early part of the month were right in the race. We lost a couple of games at home and then went to Denver. We lost 4 straight games there. By the time we got to Miami, we were pretty much out of it. We got slaughtered in the first game there. In the second game, we were down 4 or 5 runs in about the third inning. And the camera panned our dugout, and all the guys were staring down at their shoes. And I said to my broadcast partner, Bill Brown, you know what's wrong with this team, Brownie? He said, well, we're not hitting. I said, yeah, but I think it's more than that. He said, well, what is it then? Not enough Hawaiian shirts came out of my mouth from who knows where. He said, what? And I said, well, you know, you look at these guys. They look like they're at a funeral. You know, if you want to play your best, you've got to relax and loosen up a little bit. And so, you know, have you ever seen a guy wearing a Hawaiian shirt that wasn't having a good time? He said, oh, yeah, I understand. Now I get your point, but where's yours? I said, well, I'll wear it tomorrow. Well, we were staying in a hotel that was right across from a large shopping mall in Miami, Florida, and when I went there the next day to find a Hawaiian shirt, I couldn't find one single shirt in the entire mall. That's how unpopular they were. I did find a shirt with some flowers on it, and so I wore that to the game. And so, in a way, I would say that what happened that day actually had a lot to do with me being the Hawaiian shirt guy, but also something to do with how I got the manager's job. You could ask Tal Smith about that. So I come out, a fan came up when we got back to Houston and gave me two shirts. And one of them had a lot of these Woody Station wagons with the surfboards on top. And so I got home and I looked at that and I thought about, you know, what we could do. You know, you're stretching for things to talk about to entertain people when you've just blown the pennant race in September. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to wear this shirt tomorrow. And I'm going to get Milo. So I came to the ballpark and I had this shirt on. And before the game started, I said, Milo, you know what this is? He said, a station wagon? I had just learned myself that the term Woody was a slang expression for an erection. Milo is about 10 years older than me, and I knew he would not know that. So I said, no, it's not a station wagon, it's a Woody. These were the most popular cars when I was growing up in California, you know, with the surfboards and everything. That was the thing. And he said, well, I didn't know they called them that. I said, well, now you know. So Milo would set the stage. So he set the stage for a couple innings, and then maybe somebody went to the mound. I could see we had a little bit of time. So I said, Milo, I was going to say, on radio, as you know, you have to paint the picture. People can't see what you're talking about. And nobody loves to paint that picture more than Milo Hamilton. So we get to the third inning or so, and I said, Milo, how do you like my new Hawaiian shirt? You mean the one with all the woodies on it? Yeah, Milo, when you were a young fellow, did you ever have a Woody? He said, oh, no, we were much too poor. And I said, boy, that's really poor. So now I'm loosened up. Now you're loosened up. And maybe I can find my place. You know, this is one of the reasons I've written this out. This is the first audience I've ever spoken to where most of the people in the crowd know more about baseball than I do. And, you know, I can't really talk about the history of the sport. You know that. I can't really talk about sabermetrics. You know all about that. So really, about the only thing I feel like I can do is give you a sense of what it's like and how it feels from the inside out. First of all, I'd like to tell you something that you probably already know, but I want to emphasize it. Baseball is a really, really hard sport to play. A lot harder than it looks. I have often said that the game of baseball, the difficulty of the game of baseball, increases directly with your proximity to the ball. If you're watching on TV, there's nothing to it, you know? If you're up in the upper deck, it doesn't look that hard. Sometimes when the guys in the dugouts know how it is, and sometimes when a pitcher is really getting ripped, somebody will yell, "Get the married man off the infield." And that's how I felt one day when I was about 40 years old. It was my first old-timers game, and I went out and I was standing around shortstop, and I had a couple of missiles fly by me, and I was giving it the ole, and I said, "I better get out of here." So I got in the outfield, and I started looking around, and I thought, how could three guys cover all this territory? I mean, I had actually been a player not that long before that, but just in that matter of years, and just that short experience emphasized, made me realize how hard baseball really is. So, another thing that is difficult is just throwing. When I work with little kids, which I've done a few times with my son and grandsons, all I do in the early part is try to teach them how to throw the ball. Because to be successful defending, you have to be able to throw the ball to your teammate. And they're probably 10 or 11 years old before they can even throw the ball from the left side of the infield to the first baseman. So that's the start. And if you go all the way up to high school, and I know some of you guys that have been scouts and have watched amateur games can identify with this. Even in high school, they can't throw the ball to one another and catch the ball consistently. Well, you're not going to make it in baseball unless you do that. And so I'm going to ask you this question. If it's that hard to play, why are all the great athletes playing basketball and football? This is not in my notes. Here I go. There was a time about 30 or 40 years ago when the Lords of Baseball, probably looking at the Astrodome, thought the way to go was to build a big bowl with a concentric field with AstroTurf so that everything would be standard and would conform. Within 20 years, they realized that modern baseball wasn't necessarily better baseball. Wrigley Field and Fenway Park were still the most popular fields, and they were 80 years old. So one by one, the Astrodome, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Baltimore, they all switched from big bowls where you could play football and baseball to single purpose baseball fields with natural grass, which is the way it should be. Most of the parks these days are in some ways like golf courses. And I think there's a similarity between baseball and golf. These multi-purpose stadiums have a lot of quirks. They've got a lot of angles in the outfield. They have special features. They're not concentric. They're interesting. People will travel all over the country to see different ballparks. Golfers will travel all over the world to play different golf courses. And I feel like these two sports are the most difficult on the American scene. And is it a coincidence that they're the only sports we play that aren't played on a rectangle? I don't know what there is to that, but I think they're artful. You know, they're just not the same. Push it this way, push it that way. It's different. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but an inning left to play. When Cooney was out at first and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence came upon the patrons of the game. Most of the great old ballparks and golf courses were built long before any of us were born. It was a different game back then when Ernest Thayer wrote those immortal lines. 10,000 eyes were on him when he rubbed his hands in dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. And while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. 5,000 fans was a big crowd back then. These days, you'd go broke. But these days are a lot different. And so part of what I'm doing is, you know, what was it? What is it? You know a lot of it. It's just the way I look at it. Some things are still the same. The pitcher's still standing 60 feet from the hitter. The bases are still 90 feet apart. The rules haven't changed very much, but it takes so much longer to play a game now. The big clock in center field doesn't tell you when the game will end. But back in the days of Casey and on through Babe Ruth, the games lasted about 2 hours. Now they last three. So we're proud in some ways about saying baseball's a game that doesn't have a clock. And golf doesn't have a clock either. But if you're like I am, you're noticing that the pacing of the game isn't quite the same. So, if you look at a crowd, and you probably see some of these pictures in this Houston baseball book, you've got the pictures of the crowds back in Babe Ruth's day. You see almost no women and children, first of all. The men are dressed in business attire. They may be wearing newsboys' caps, bowlers, Hombergs, or the occasional boater, and they were almost always smoking big cigars. In the sensitivity of the 21st century, you don't see anything like that anymore. Almost nobody's dressed in business attire. There's lots of kids, there's lots of women, and instead of cigars, they have cell phones. So it's a different day and a different era. Personally, I would prefer a stogie on a cool day. And if you had Luis Gonzalez on your team, you would probably get the good Havana cigars when you win the pennant. But when I started broadcasting, the commercial break between innings was 60 seconds. When I was pitching, I could go out to the mound and warm up and be ready for the first hitter in a minute. No problem. But now the breaks are two minutes long or 2.5 minutes long. And I know that Fred Arnold with the Minute Maid doesn't mind that because I do nice commercials for Minute Maid and we spend that time sometimes talking about baseball history. But it is a long break and sometimes the players sit on the bench when the inning's over and they don't even run out to their position until 30 seconds or a minute's gone by because they don't want to stand around there all that time. So that part's built in. You know, we're not going to change the commercial part of baseball. We have to make the money to buy the players to provide the entertainment that we enjoy so much. But I think the other half hour that gets us to 3 minutes is something that we might be able to do something about. In a way, it's another thing that reminds me of golf. A lot of times I'll be playing and I can tell the foursome in front of us, they're good players. You know, we can see their swings. They get on the green, they're walking all around and taking their time. And somebody, probably me, says, these guys must have a lot of money on the line. Well, think about how that relates to baseball now. You've got the pitcher, he's walking around the mound, talking to himself, you know, looking at see what notes on the bottom of his hat, and he's trying to figure out what he's going to throw for the next pitch. It's kind of like a golfer walking all around trying to line up a putt. There's a lot of money on it. And you see the hitter, and the hitter steps out of the box. He fixes his batting gloves. He takes a couple of breaths. He gets back into the batter's box. He's moving his feet like this. He puts his hand back to the umpire because he's not quite ready yet. And then when he's finally ready, okay, he's ready to hit. All that stuff takes time. It doesn't take a lot of time, but you know, if you could take 10 seconds here, 15 there, and stretch that out over the course of the game, I think you save a lot of time. Case in point, the 1941 World Series, Game 4. Dodgers up 4-3, two outs in the ninth. Two strikes in the count, and you know the rest. Tommy Henrich swings. He misses Hugh Casey's spitter. It gets by Mickey Owen. Henrich reaches first base. The Yankees come back and win the game. I doubt if many of you have heard Mel Allen's call of that sequence, but I have. And what amazes me more than anything was it was no more than 5 seconds after the passed ball that Allen said, so Henrich reaches first, now the first pitch to DiMaggio. 5 seconds? I mean, he says it so fast, it was almost like DiMaggio was running up to the batter's box while Henrich was running down to first base, and the pitcher was ready to throw as soon as Jolton Joe got in there. So if you heard that, you know, you would say, hey, the game was different back then. You know, this couldn't happen. If it happened now, it would be 5 minutes, not 5 seconds. I mean, they'd have a meeting on the mound. They'd probably change pitchers. There might be a conference with the umpire. The next pitch would be a long time coming. As a broadcaster, I was amused from time to time when one of our cameras would pick up somebody in the stands reading a book. And, of course, most people thought that was sacrilege. Well, I want to tell you, when I watch games at home, I read a book now. I can read a lot and not miss anything. So, you know, I love the game. No matter how long it takes to play it, I still love the game. But I think we could pick up the pace. Sometimes it seems like it gets to the point of paralysis by analysis. I'm not the first one to voice this concern. And this is where I must insert the disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this speech are mine. I do not speak for MLB or the Houston Astros. So here's what I do about it. The first thing is I would elevate the home plate umpire to the position of God. He would signal the batter to get into the batter's box or the pitcher to get onto the rubber. Get in and hit, or it's strike one. Get up there and pitch, or it's ball one. Now, he wouldn't like that. You know, it would cause a little anxiety, a little bad blood. Players probably wouldn't like it right away either, but I think they could get used to it. What would surely infuriate the home plate umpire is what I would do next. I always thought that I could call balls and strikes better from the mound than the umpire. Honestly, even the ones where I threw a ball and he called it a strike, if I was on the mound, I knew what it was. If it was a strike and he called it a ball, the other way around, but I thought I could do a better job. I think I can call balls and strikes better by watching TV than I could if I was crouching behind the catcher. The catcher's moving around, the pitches are darting in and out, and this guy back there is supposed to try to call where they cross that plane at the front of home plate. It's really hard. I don't think I could do that better than they can do it. I just think it could be done better from the vantage point behind the pitcher rather than behind the catcher. So, my modest proposal is that I would use that technology. I put a little buzzer in the home plate umpire's left pocket and another one in his right. And with the pitch across the plate, he would know if it's a ball or a strike. He'd get, the ball would be over here, the strike would be over here, and it wouldn't add 1 second to the playing time of the game. The pitchers would like it because it would be consistent. The hitters the same way. When I started pitching, they said, look, you've got to learn the umpire's strike zone and pitch to his zone. Well, sometimes you'd throw a pitch and it would be a borderline pitch and he'd call it a strike. And you get to 3-2 and you throw the same exact pitch and he calls it a ball. Well, how can you get used to that? It just, you know, for me, it only makes sense. But, you know, it is the way it is, and it's probably not going to change. So, what I would end up doing, the point of it all would be that I would hope to achieve a system where the home plate umpire, as God, is the most important arbiter in the game, not because he could call Casey out on strikes, but because he would dictate the pace of the game. As long as I'm this far out on a limb, let me say that I am no fan of the replay system either. It only shows that the umpires miss a fair number of really close calls. It probably adds 10 minutes to each game, and by my reckoning, all those missed calls would even out over the course of 162 games. Of course, it's hard for things to even out in a short series. And I do think the replay system would be good in postseason because one or two calls could change the whole series. When you play 162 to get in the playoffs, you don't want to get knocked out of the playoffs by one bad umpire's call. So I would, you know, who cares if the game lasts a little longer then? I would use it in the playoffs. The regular season, I'd say, get on with it. You know, I can't tell you how silly it seems to me, how ridiculous it looks to me to see a manager strolling out onto the field to talk to the umpire that he thinks has just missed a call, and then standing there and talking amiably with him, looking to the dugout and waiting to get the signal as to whether the call was the right call or the wrong call. I mean, I think there was a good bit of theater in the old way. You know, you think about Billy Martin, Earl Weaver, Lou Piniella, Tommy Lasorda out there stomping around and throwing their hats down. You know, it was kind of fun to watch stuff like that. It's, for me, you know, where is the entertainment value in walking out and going, hey, you know, how's it going? What do you think about it? Did you see that movie? You know, what are they doing? There's no entertainment value in that, so I'd get rid of it. And one more thing, as long as I'm at it, it's time to modify the designated hitter rule and get both leagues on the same page. Well, you're cheering, but you know it's not going to happen. I have a compromise that I think would be better. It would allow the great hitters to play a couple more years after they're no longer good fielders. It would put the manager in a strategic bind as early as the second or third inning. it would drive the general manager crazy trying to get the roster right for his manager. And I think that the new rule would be better because it has that timeless quality of simplicity. The simple rule would be a manager can pinch hit for his pitcher anytime he wants to without removing the pitcher from the game. But the player who hits for him may not come back in the game. Chew on that for a while. Think about that. It's a second inning. The pitcher's up. You got men on second and third. You've got a hitter on your bench that you've saved on your bench because he can hit this pitcher, but he's not a very good fielder. Do you expend him in the second inning and can't bring him back in the ninth inning because he's also had some luck against the other team's closer? Think of what you'd have to do as a manager if you had to think about whether to hit for the pitcher every time he came up. For me, I was a save your bullets manager. Most of the time, I would just let the pitcher hit. I'd want to have all my weapons when I got down to the later part of the game because I've noticed, you probably have too, a lot of games, one team starts out way ahead, the other team comes back. You know, it looks like it's one way, then it's the other. And then the games where you would at least expect it, you're in the eighth or ninth inning, and it's a close game, and the managers are all out of pinch hitters and relief pitchers. So I was a save your bullets guy. But even, you know, other guys that like to strike when the iron's hot, I think it would make it really interesting. I think, you know, you could be second-guessing the manager in the second inning. And anyway, I think it would be better. And I think you wouldn't be saying we got to get rid of these great hitters. You could keep them for situations. You just couldn't use them four times. So, finally, since I've been ragging on the game enough to suggest that I'm not pleased with it, I've saved the best for last. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. A band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. That matchup between the great hitter and the great pitcher with the game on the line is still the most riveting tableau in all of sports. And that goes for Casey, for the Babe, Splendid Splinter, Jolting Joe. It goes for Willie, Mickey, and for Henry. For every great hitter who has come after and is still to come. And for all the great pitchers who have looked down at them when it's 3-2 and it's me and you. Thank you.